Hello and welcome to the Our Science podcast, bringing you all the latest highlights from around the Royal Society. I'm Emma Woods.
And I'm Peter Gallimore.
This month, we're going to hear about the future of health and medicine. We've got lots of interesting guests covering everything from computers that help people to see to personalised medicine. But first, let's get an insight into the future of antibiotics with Dr. Christophe Corps. Dr. Corps, one of our research fellows, recently held a Café Scientifique at the Royal Society to address the very important question, where and how can we find new antibiotics?
My research is at the interface between chemistry and biology. And in fact, our aims are to discover novel antibiotics, but also to try developing new strategies for antibiotic discovery.
So you're here at the Royal Society to hold a Café Scientifique on where and how we can find novel antibiotics. So what are the challenges facing us in these areas of research?
So the main two challenges, I think, which are facing us are the fact that there are some multi-drug resistant superbugs. So these are bacteria which cause infection, but which we cannot cure with common antibiotics. And they are spreading very rapidly. So we need to find a solution to control them in such a way that we could still use existing antibiotics. And the second main problem is that we have not enough new antibiotics. 50 years ago, we could discover tens of new antibiotics every single year. But nowadays, in fact, in 25 years, you can find just a handful of new antibiotics. So that's a concerning challenge. Yeah.
Another area of health and medicine at an exciting point in its development is stem cell research. Earlier this year, Professor Fiona Watt gave a public lecture at the Royal Society about stem cells and human health. She spoke to the Our Science podcast team about recent developments and the potential for stem cell research to affect modern medicine.
My name's Fiona Watt. I'm director of the Centre for Stem Cells and Regenerative Medicine at King's College London.
And what are you here to speak to us today about?
I'm a great enthusiast for stem cell research. So I'm going to make the case that this is an area that the public should be interested in because I believe it offers a lot of hope for treating diseases that are currently incurable.
What do you think is the next big development in stem cell research?
That question is impossible to answer. Almost every week something is published that none of us expected. So last week, you'll remember there was the report that by squeezing cells or exposing them to acid, they can take on stem cell characteristics. I certainly would have predicted that. I think the one thing I would predict is that the push to take research towards the clinic is definitely underway, and that's very heartening.
Could you tell us a little bit about the practical applications of stem cell research?
There are a number of different applications of the research. We often think that new treatments will involve transplanting cells into the body. That could be the case. But another very important application of the research is for improved strategies for drug discovery. Also, in combination with more conventional treatments like organ transplants or hip replacements, that could be improved. And there's also a real interest in whether you could use drugs or other approaches to stimulate a person's own stem cells to repair the body.
From the future of antibiotics and stem cell research, to one of our long-term antagonists, the bacterium Staphylococcus aureus.
We recently caught a lecture by Professor Hugh Pennington, CBE, as part of the Royal College of Pathology's 50th anniversary celebrations. Fellows of the college were asked to nominate objects that have changed the practice of pathology, and the most popular now feature in a book, A History of Pathology in 50 Objects.
In his lecture, Staphylococcus aureus, Biography of a Bug, Sometimes Super, Most Often Not, Professor Pennington explains why he chose S. aureus as his nominated object, how humans have attempted to thwart the bacterium throughout the ages, from carbolic sprays to penicillin, and how we might go about controlling the spread of this evolving adversary.
Staphylococcus aureus, I picked it as a biography because it's a really important organism. About 30% of you in this room will be carrying it up your noses or in other parts of your body. even those of you who are not carrying it, and there are some people who seem to be resistant to carrying it, might well suffer from it if you go into hospital and have a surgical operation. It's a ubiquitous organism and a big challenge. If you died in an operation, which many people did, you would die because you had a wound infection and a surgical infection and a bone infection caused by the staphylococcus. Not always staph, but nearly always the staphylococcus. And that is still the case. If people have surgery nowadays and they get an infection, the commonest bug that causes that is Staphylococcus aureus. So although time has moved on, we have much less of the infection. We've reduced the infection rate very, very significantly. We haven't eliminated it. Alexander Ogston was a very good surgeon, very good with his hands. He was also a bacteriologist. And a lot of the staphylococcal bacteriology is surgical pathology. You know, pathology is not just doing postmortems. If you look at the 50 objects, you'll see it's about a whole range. It affects the whole of medicine. Well, it doesn't. It benefits the whole of medicine. It doesn't affect it. But Alexander Ogston was a surgical pathologist, very keen on the antiseptic spray. The students wrote a poem about, well, a rhyme about him. The spray, the antiseptic spray. A.O., that's Alexander Ogston, would shower it morning, night, and day for every sort of scratch where others would attach a sticking plaster patch, he gave the spray. Now, the spray was not just used to keep the staff at bay, either in the field or in the operating theatre. It was used in the wards, and this is the ward in Aberdeen Royal Infirmary. The building still exists, but it's no longer used as an infirmary, I'm happy to say. And you can see a boy here having his wound dressed with the spray squirting at him, and one only hopes that everybody was looking at their urine, because when your urine went black, it was time to go on holiday if you were a surgeon, because the carbolic had got to your kidneys. Okay, so things move on. We move away from the frock coat. Remember that first picture? Although, you know, it was carbolic and it was antiseptic, you were still wearing the blood-stained frock coat, like, you know, the butcher and so on. You've now got linen coats. Operating coats. Before we got gowns, we're still worried about the staff. This is a surgeon in Hamburg called Scheder, and this is his laparotomy room. Linen coats, 85 degrees Fahrenheit, room full of antiseptic vapor, and the floor is drenched with antiseptic as well. They'd moved away from carbolic, they've now gone on to mercuric chloride, which is much more effective at killing bacteria. Even worse for the patients than carbolic. I was puzzled when I started my microbiology career. I was very puzzled that all the staphylococci were mercury resistant. It was a sort of test you could apply. If it was a nasty staph, it was mercury resistant. Why should it be mercury resistant? It was because they were using mercury as a disinfectant, as an antiseptic at the end of the 19th century, before they moved over to the complete asepsis system. And the bug had responded by becoming resistant to mercury. And it doesn't do it just by, you know, putting a wall against the mercury. It actually can take the mercury in, convert it, and then excrete it out. And it does it with a transposon, which is a bit of DNA that flies about, which gives it also a sort of cassette of DNA. It helps the bug to get antibiotic resistant as well. So unknowingly, when we were using mercuric chloride, we were helping the bug to develop a genetic system that it could use later on when the antibiotics came along. And boy, has it taken advantage of that. Big change, 1928, crucial year in the history of, in the biography of Staph aureus. If you Google Bundaberg disaster, you get three disasters in Bundaberg. And one was the Bundaberg disaster when children were given diphtheria vaccine, TAM vaccine. It was a vaccine which is no longer used. In 27th of January, the vaccine that was used, it killed 12 of the 21 children who'd been immunized. And they died because a staphylococcus had grown in the vial where the vaccine was. Bundaberg is in Queensland, semi-tropical part of Australia. The vial had been kept on the windowsill. You know, you can imagine 30 degrees humming away there. Reused, the vial had been used many times and the staph had got into the vial and grown and produced a toxin. These children, they didn't suffer very long. They died quite quickly because the toxin had built up in the vaccine vial, so they were poisoned by the toxin rather than by the bug itself. And then in September, well, we had Alexander Fleming discovering penicillin. So 1928 was, it was good for the staff at the beginning and bad for the staff towards the end. Now, what was Alexander Fleming doing when he discovered the Staphylococcus? When he discovered penicillin? He was working on the Staphylococcus. A paper had come out saying, why was Staphylococcus yellow? Because it's called Staph aureus. Why is it yellow? And Fleming was trying to work this out when he discovered penicillin by accident. It was accidental, but what Fleming's genius was, okay, he didn't manage to get penicillin to a state where he could use it for treating patients. He tried once or twice, but it's quite a sensitive compound to handle in the lab. But he kept it, and he published it. So it was there when Florey in Oxford came, you know, later on in the early 1940s onto a project. This was a project that took his fancy. He thought that Fleming was dead. You know, Fleming was some figure from the past, and then eventually Fleming appears in the lab. I thought you were dead, you know, but anyway. Fleming had shown himself that antibiotic resistance, that the staph could get resistant to penicillin. Well, it couldn't get. Some staphs were already resistant to penicillin before it had been introduced therapeutically. And he showed this in 1942. He said this, I think, in his Nobel lecture, that this is something we have to worry about. And a penicillin bill was introduced into Parliament by Nye Bevan to control the sale of penicillin. It basically meant that you had to buy it, you could only get it on prescription, you couldn't go and buy it over the chemist's counter, because of the possibility of resistance. How wise? Well, not wise enough in the sense that that didn't stop people using it inappropriately, but wise nevertheless. Mary Barber, who was a bacteriologist who worked at St. Thomas's and at the Hammersmith Hospital here in London, she showed in 1948 that penicillin resistance was getting commoner and commoner and commoner, particularly in the Hammersmith Hospital, which was a top quality teaching hospital. And it wasn't because each individual bug was mutating to get resistant. It was because one or two bugs had become resistant and then spread through the hospital. And of course, she basically laid down the ground rules for controlling the spread of antibiotic resistance in hospitals, which we've been rather poor at following through. We're just about getting there now. Epidemic MRSA, I don't think I have to define what an MRSA, methicillin-resistant. It's quite a long story, methicillin-resistant. Methicillin was, as an antibiotic derivative of penicillin was developed by Beecham's, developed by them in the late 1950s, because methicillin is not chewed up by the enzyme that staph uses to chew up penicillin to make it resistant to penicillin. The sort that Mary Barber was looking at, the staph produced an enzyme which chewed the penicillin up, so the bug was, it could live in the presence of the drug. Methicillin is not chewed up by the enzyme, by the penicillinase. So we thought, this is wonder drug. This will be the end of Staph aureus. Within a year, methicillin-resistant strains appeared. Also in Surrey, Beecham Lab was in Surrey, and Guildford the first. And then the first outbreak was also in Surrey at Queen Mary's Hospital in Carshalton a couple of years later. And it was, the staph had a completely different mechanism developing resistance. If you take radioactive penicillin and feed it to a staphylococcus and then chew up the staphylococcus down to the level of individual proteins, you can see the penicillin binding protein, because the penicillin binds very strongly to the protein, and you can run it on an agar gel, on a gel, and see the band where the radioactive penicillin is binding to the protein. MRSA, that protein no longer binds penicillin. So, the bug just goes on chewing away, because the penicillin binding protein is necessary for basically making the cell wall of the bug. Anyway, it sort of hung around. MRSA hung around for years and years and years, and it sort of came and it went, and we thought, it's no more virulent. MRSA is no more virulent than the ordinary staph, which is bad enough. But it's not a hotter kind of bug. So let's not worry too much about it. 1992, it really took off. It started in Kettering. This is clone 16 of the MRSA, our particular British variant. 1994, it had spread to 21 London hospitals, and then by 2000, it took quite a while for it to get north. The MRSA spread by being carried by patients who picked it up. Some of them had not actually been infected with it in the sense of having an illness. They just had it growing in their noses, like many of you have ordinary stuff. Some of you may even have MRSA up your noses, I don't know. Probably very few, but one or two might. So it spread by patients moving from one hospital to another. And by 2003, it had really become a major, major, major problem in hospitals. And by around about 2005, it became a political organism, and we started to do something about it. And then money started to flow. And by now, of course, we've managed to see a substantial decline in the MRSA. Not necessarily by purely attacking the organism, but by doing the sort of things that Mary Barber was recommending in 1946, and also paying attention to things like Venflons, you know, these things you have stuck in the back of your hand so that you can give an injection down a little tube that's inserted in a vein. If you don't look after those properly, the staff really has a field day and gets into the bloodstream and can cause all sorts of nasty infections. So attention to detail, which is the sort of thing that Joseph Lister was talking about in the 1870s, is the absolute key to success. The difficult things are some patients shed enormous numbers of staphylococcus. They're surrounded by a sort of cloud of staphylococcus as they walk along. You don't know why. This is one of these other unanswered questions. It's very common in microbiology that this is what happens. These are the things that we have to worry about when we try to control infection. We have super spreaders, we have high-risk patients, patients who are more likely to get infected because they've already got something wrong with them, their immune systems are down, they've got wounds and so on, allowing the bug to get in. Intensive care units, very difficult to control infection there. Many of the patients in an intensive care unit are there because they have an infection. And they're very, very difficult because everybody has pipes and tubes and so on. Very difficult places to control the infection in. Decontaminating, I said you can treat a carrier by putting antibiotics up their nose. It works for 75%, but not for 25% of them. And then, of course, human nature, that if we say all the MRSA positive patients will have to be isolated, well, sometimes they're not. And we've got still the staff with us, causing problems, many unanswered questions about how it does it, unanswered questions of how we're going to sort it, and remember that evolution, this bug evolves in real time. So even if we think we've sorted it, it'll come up with something new, like the fast type 8081. We don't know where it came from. We don't know why it disappeared. Next time, it might throw up something like that again, which might not disappear. So on that happy note, I'll conclude. Thank you very much.
Could computers help blind and partially sighted people to see? Oxford University's Dr. Stephen Hicks is the winner of the 2013 Royal Society Brian Mercer Award for Innovation. This follows his development of a pair of glasses that help those with poor vision to identify obstacles, allowing them to get around on their own. We caught up with him before we spoke at one of our events to find out more.
Tonight I'm giving an overview of my work in visual prosthetics. Some of the ideas that we've been thinking about in order to help improve sight for people who are partially sighted. Some of these kind of key themes are around the idea of blindness, particularly. What is blindness and what are the many different types you have? What are some of the phenomena that people are still able to detect and how we've been able to use that in a meaningful way to help people, first of all, improve mobility, but then get into scenarios where we can actually help them identify and respond to other things in the environment. So in order to do that, what we take are some of the leading ideas from computer vision. And computer vision is a vast field, but it's one of its main things is to try to get computers and cameras to automatically understand aspects of the world. obviously people who have got serious sight impairments, that's the key difficulty is working out what things are and where they are and whether that's important to them right now. This is uncannily similar to what they're trying to do in computer vision, where it's particularly trying to get robots to understand their environment or autonomous cars to understand where they are and how to get around. So some of the algorithms that people have made are really easily adoptable, or adaptable rather, over to sight impaired people, which will be able to help, hopefully help be able to identify things of interest and make a smooth and intuitive experience so people can use what sight they have in a more meaningful way.
So one thing that you've been working on are the glasses that you've been developing. Could you speak a bit about those?
Yeah, so about 3 years ago when I was working on retinal implants, these are the synthetic chips that I actually place in the eye for people who are totally blind, started to realize that a lot of this work can be translated to a pair of glasses, basically a set of spectacles that aren't really that overly complicated, but it would be able to provide simple visual descriptions of objects nearby that may be able to help people to recognize objects, particularly for walking around. So over the last 3 years, mostly funded by the Department of Health and the NIHR, I've run through a series of prototypes and validation experiments to build a pair of glasses. In fact, we've probably built about 12 different pairs of glasses. Some looked great, some look awful, and all mixtures in between. Really to try to produce something which is going to be an acceptable aid for people who are visually impaired. So by acceptable, it needs to be something which will ultimately look like a regular pair of glasses. As you might imagine, if you've got a digital display, which is really at the core of the glasses, basically like a mobile phone or a virtual reality screen, you don't want that covering your eyes completely. If you hadn't built that into a nice pair of sunglasses, that would work. But if you want to just have your eyes visible to other people, so you can have a relatively natural form of communication with someone, then some of the key design steps for these glasses is how to make them look regular. So they're able to see through, people are able to see each other's eyes. But on the wearer's side, we're still able to put bright information that is useful in day-to-day lives. So how the glasses really work is they pick up the three-dimensional structure of the environment around. Not the same as you might have with a mobile phone, but you have a thing called a depth camera, which people have developed for computer games and robots and all sorts of fun stuff like that. The camera picks up the shape and position of nearby things, and then we turn that into really just simply into a very bright display. So nearby things retain their shape, but they get brighter as they come towards you. So if you imagine you're out in a plane in the middle of a football pitch with nothing around, the glasses won't pick up anything. If you look down, you'll see the ground, and that will be a bright object. But if someone walked up towards you, you would see the shape of the person getting continuously brighter until they're standing right in front of you. And for people who have got even just the most basic of sight, that can be enough for you to, first of all, recognize an object is in front of you. And then with a little bit of training, not too much, half an hour or so, you can work out what that object is. Is it a pole or a tree? It'd be a bit weird if that was walking, I guess. But we've got the stereotypical movements that humans have. And that's very easy for people to work out. This is a person. You can work out the gender, some aspects of the mood. And you can definitely see arms moving and things like that. So for people who've got the very basic of sight, this can give a structure to the world around them, which hopefully then they can pin on top of it their expectations of what these things are. This is my friend, this is the clothes they'd be wearing, or this is a wall or a doorway, or getting a better understanding of the situation and the spatial arrangement of objects around them, so you can behave more independently. We spent quite a bit of time working with groups like the RNIB and also some focus groups on our own to work out the major issues that people face in day-to-day lives. The in order, really, they are reading. Everyone would like to be able to read. Recognizing faces and expressions and walking around independently. We're dealing with the third one of those because we don't really have the equipment, the visual display to look at version one and two. I mean, sorry, issue one and two. But after you've got mobility, what people need to do is find items of interest. So things like bus signs and bus numbers, menus at cafes, things that have text on them, but that you really can't get around reading. We're not going to be able to produce a display which can reproduce the sense of sight, but we can do audio descriptions of such things. So one of the key demonstrators that we're working on is a bus detector, so you can get yourself to the bus using GPS and that simple direction headings that I was talking about earlier on. And then once you find a bus, it can tell the number of the bus that's coming to you, which might sound like a very simple thing, but actually in terms of computer vision, it's gigantically difficult. The problems of trying to do object recognition in changing light, so right now at 6 o'clock, the light's a certain way. Different times of the day, the sun may be glancing, or it might be snowing, it might be pitch black. And for us, it's fine, because we know what letters look like, but a computer needs to be literally told what all these things are. So it's not unsolvable, but what I found quite interesting is that what always seem to me to be pretty straightforward questions are actually ones where you've got a whole area of new research which is going on. One thing I've found which has been really beneficial for this is that the computer vision algorithms and the processes that underlie the type of detection that we're thinking of are ones that PhD students and postdocs around the world are all working on, but often they don't really have an application for their work. So they've come on board with a project and are looking at detecting gestures of people in the environment, say. So I come along with my project and say, we're trying to help people see, and everyone just goes, yeah, great, I'll contribute to that. And it's meant that we've been able to speed things along by attracting people who like to work, 3 months or 6 months and contribute some code or just discussions, papers they've read that are interesting. And that's made it so we've been able to push along with these specific computer vision questions in a way that I've thought is much quicker than I would have expected before. So much so that we've got demonstration models that are about ready to run on mobile phones that we can try out with our glasses and take this into the real world and start looking at some of the things outside the lab, some of the questions that you don't find in controlled environments.
And finally, we asked Dr. Hicks, why science?
Well, I got into science, I think really because my dad was a scientist. The talks that I had when I was a child and a teenager were ones that really showed how beautiful the world is. And it became more and more interesting, more intricate, continually fascinating, the more I understood about how chemical processes work, the questions about what is matter. Ultimately, I discovered space, and that's the thing I've been really interested in for such a long time. As you find out more, I think one of the reason why I think science is such an important and fulfilling thing is that you do really understand more and more about the world. It's not the case that you find that you solve a problem and you go, that's it, and don't have to move on from there. But every generation thinks they solve a lot of the world's problems about cosmology or what is a mind, what makes up societies. And then you'll find the next generation kind of changes all that and says, no, we've discovered more things. It's actually more like this. So it's the continual digging into reality and finding out what it is that we live in and what we are is the reason I like science.